I just have to be honest with you. There are too many Republicans in Congress right now who refuse to compromise even an inch when it comes to closing tax loopholes and special interest tax breaks.
What the president meant to say was,
there are too many Republicans in Congress right now.
Welcome to a special sequester semester edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Emeritus Rudin.
Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's so great to have you here, even though you're having to step down from some of your duties.
But we're on the periphery of the sequester.
Yes, this is the last day, as we record this podcast, of the pre-sequester universe. And we will be falling off immediately into the post-sequester universe tomorrow.
There's so many things that fascinate me about this whole story. The fact is that the president will meet with the congressional leaders on Friday, not in the last couple of weeks leading up to the end of the world coming sequester.
But right after the end of the world.
Yeah,
I think that's the right time. I mean, it makes sense. In fact, he has to actually issue a sequester order at some time during March 1st.
Right.
So it could be at like a minute past midnight, or it could be a minute before midnight on Friday night going into Saturday. And somewhere in the middle of that day, he's going to meet with the people he has not been negotiating with all these weeks and months.
And the reason he hasn't been negotiating with them is he's been out casting aspersions on the Republican Party.
Well, he's been out casting aspersions on the Republican Party nonstop during the election, of course, and campaigning on his approach to how to deal with the fiscal cliff and the sequester. Actually, the sequester was part of the original fiscal cliff. All through last year, he talked about how he wanted to reduce the deficit through a balanced approach of higher taxes and some spending cuts for both defense and non-defense. And that was pretty clearly what he was campaigning on. He won the election, so as far as he's concerned, that ends the argument, and Congress is just being silly for not adopting his program. Meanwhile, the Republicans campaigned on not having any tax increases and, in fact, having primarily cuts in non-defense programs, and they held the House. I mean, they got 234 seats. They've got a clear majority, and they feel like they were vindicated. All but 11 of the Tea Party class from 2010 are back. They've got a whole new Tea Party class from 2012, and they're standing their ground, too, and so here we are.
But I think what the president did not anticipate is that the Republican Party would not knuckle under the threat of a $600 billion cut in Pentagon spending. That he figured that, well, you know, I mean, the Republicans will never go along with this.
Never.
Because they are the Pentagon party. They are the party of military spending.
Well, they are the party of peace through strength.
Yes. But at the same time, the Republicans said, first of all, we gave during the fiscal cliff negotiations.
You got your revenue, Mr. President.
You got your tax on the rich that you promised you would push through. And the Republicans also said, look, if we believe in cutting spending, if we believe in reducing the size of government, as we say we do, then the sequester absolutely makes sense. It's not going to frighten us away from sticking to our guns.
That's right. Jim Jordan, who is not the speaker from Ohio, but another Republican from that state, he's the head of the Republican Study Committee in the House that really speaks for, if you will, the Tea Party consciousness here. And he has said, yeah, the sequester is going to happen and it won't be the end of the world. So we have here set up a kind of contest that will be decided, I guess, by the polls of public opinion. And the contest says, will people really mind these cuts, these across-the-board sequester-style cuts, or won't they in the weeks ahead as Congress and the president negotiate over the next crisis?
Probably even a bigger crisis.
Which is definitely a bigger crisis. That is now called the continuing resolution. But forget what it's called. It's the basic funding to keep everything in the government functioning at all.
That comes March 27th. And if, of course, there's no agreement by then the entire government, including this podcast, shuts down.
Well, as the listener is probably aware, we're not a function of the government. We do not depend on the government for our funding. So we'll still be here 4 weeks from today, even if the federal government shuts down, I'm glad to say, so the listener need not worry. But if the listener actually does care about the actual functions of the federal government, air traffic control, defending the shores, delivering the mail, and all that sort of thing, that would be a real blackout. This sequester thing is like a rolling brownout. With the ending of the normal funding of the federal government in 4 weeks, then you would really have a full shutdown.
I don't get the sense, though, that, I mean, I know even the president seems to be talking less about the henny-penny end of the world than he has been in the past couple of weeks. More recently, he seems to be saying, well, it may not be as drastic as some think or as we've been saying. I mean, look, The front page of every newspaper is that sequester is near, the end of the world is approaching, but I still don't know if the American people are worked up about this.
They're shrugging it off. Yeah. They consider
it. We've been there before.
Yes, and let's face it. I mean, the government has cried wolf many times like this before, or if you want to bring in the media, and we certainly have a big role in this, the government cries wolf, we cry Wolf Blitzer.
I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room.
Yes, yes. But the good news is at least that the leaders in Congress, Speaker John Boehner and Democratic Senate leader Harry Reid, at least they're talking about the real issues that are involved.
Yes, let's listen.
For 16 months, the president's been traveling all over the country holding rallies instead of sitting down with Senate leaders in order to try to forge an agreement over there in order to move a bill. We have moved a bill in the House twice. We should not have to move a third bill before the Senate gets off their ass and begins to do something.
Okay, a little reality check.
Right, there's no guy named Bill. Who's Bill?
No, there is no Bill. I mean, the Speaker has continually referred to the House having moved a bill, meaning passed a bill that would foreclose or avert the sequester. In fact, that was in the last Congress that they did this, and they have not passed another bill in this Congress. So there is no bill that the Senate could take up from the House or that the President could sign at this point. The Speaker continually acts as though there were, but the bills that were passed by the House were in the last session, and they died when the last Congress went home.
So how does Harry Reid deal with this?
Well, Harry had a very mature response.
I think he should understand who is sitting on their posterior. We're doing our best here to pass something. The Speaker is doing nothing to try to pass anything over there. He's falling back onto what he said they did last Congress.
I'm going to have a moment of sympathy here for America's political leaders because clearly, A, they need it, and B, I think it is not entirely their fault. You know whose fault it is, Ken?
The San Andreas fault.
It's your fault.
Really?
And my fault. Really? And all Americans' fault. We are, in fact, all responsible for Congress being so schizophrenic about spending cuts and tax hikes. Pew Research Center. They've done a lot of polling on this issue, and they find that people think we need a balanced approach. That's what people say they want. Tax increases and spending cuts. Mostly spending cuts, not so much tax increases. All right, that's all believable. Then they ask, what should we cut? What do people want us to cut?
The podcast. No, that's the problem with the sequester, because the sequester takes a meat axe and just hacks indiscriminately.
Now, the problem is that if you ask people about, you know, foreign aid, they'll say, well, maybe keep it about the same. You ask about defense spending, they say keep it about the same or maybe increase it. You ask them about Social Security, it's keep it the same or increase it. There is no significant-sized function of the federal government that a majority of voters say that's where we should make the cuts.
So is a sequester the way to deal with it? I mean, it may be the only way to deal with it.
It might be that or a government shutdown outright. Of course, the irony is that if you shut the government down for 2 or 3 weeks, you don't save 2 or 3 weeks' worth of the government spending because you have to come back and do it all again. And in many cases, it's downright counterproductive. You spend more in the long run because you had to shut the government down and start it back up again.
At least the Senate came to terms on Chuck Hagel this week.
Yes. Two votes on Chuck Hagel. First, they had an argument about whether or not they were having a filibuster.
Right.
And then they shut down the filibuster with a little over 70 votes willing to do so, including some of the biggest critics who were subsequently going to vote against Hagel's actual nomination, but who were willing to back down from the confrontation with the president and not filibuster any longer.
But still, 41 Republicans voted against Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense. In the history of the Defense Department, no defense secretary has been confirmed with that much opposition. And, you know, Harry Reid was on the floor the other day and said that, what did the Republicans accomplish? You know, what a waste of time. I think the Republicans got what they wanted out of this. They wanted to embarrass Chuck Hagel. They wanted to do to Chuck Hagel what they feel Chuck Hagel has been doing to them over the years.
Meaning what?
By dissing President Bush, dissing President Bush's war policy, campaigning for Democrats around the country, including most recently Bob Kerry in Nebraska.
So they didn't desert Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel deserted them, and they were just feeding it back.
Well, I think a lot of it was retribution. The fact is that he did not endorse his old pal John McCain for president in 2008. McCain never forgets a snub like that, and that's why McCain and his allies like Lindsey Graham were so angry at Chuck Hagel. So Chuck Hagel comes to the Defense Department as a wounded defense secretary. I don't know how effective he will be or won't be, because ultimately it's not going to change what Iran is doing, what North Korea is doing, and what Syria is doing. Those are major problems, but at least as far as the personal, that seems to have ended at least with the 58-41 vote.
Chuck Hagel got 4 Republican votes in that final confirmation test. What was the most surprising of the Republican votes in your mind?
Well, a lot of people focused more on Rand Paul of Kentucky than anybody else, but actually that makes sense. Given what Chuck Hagel feels about war, about U.S. involvement in wars, that seems to be the Rand Paul / Ron Paul philosophy, that no foreign wars, no foreign entanglements, and in a sense, Rand Paul, everybody said, wow, even Rand Paul voted for him, but I think Chuck Hagel enunciated the kind of foreign policy, or at least in his earlier speeches and votes, the kind of thing that Rand Paul would support.
Also confirmed for the cabinet this week, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, the former chief of staff at the White House, the guy a lot of people think came up with the idea of having a sequester in that last debt ceiling deal back in 2011 that set us up for the sequester that we're going into now.
I thought the vote against him was interesting in the fact that, yes, 25 of the 26 votes were Republicans.
That's right. And the 26th vote came from Bernie Sanders, the former socialist mayor of Burlington, Vermont, who is now an independent senator, but usually votes with the Democrats, usually votes with the president. But he was so unhappy about Jack Lew's history with Citicorp and his history as a Wall Street mogul, an investment banker. This is the center of all evil for Bernie. He didn't want to vote for Jack Lew, even if he was the president's man.
That seemed to have been, for the longest time, the argument for the progressive left against both the Obama and the Clinton economic policies, that they got a lot of their top guys from Wall Street. And if anybody's responsible, in their eyes, for the economic meltdown, at least as we saw it after 2008, it was the Wall Street and the banks.
As many as did during the George W. Bush years.
Yeah, but that's expected. Because
yeah, that would be expected.
Right, because that's the party of the Wall Street. But if the Democrats campaign against Wall Street, and yet they bring their guys in from Wall Street, there's a little hypocrisy there, one would think. And it's interesting that it was only somebody like Bernie Sanders who would speak out against it.
That's right. You know, a lot of this goes back to Robert Rubin in
1993, Robert Rubin, exactly.
The Clinton pick for Treasury Secretary, who was so much the dominant figure in the financial and economic thinking of the Clinton years. And a lot of these guys who have been in government since are his proteges.
Tim Geithner.
Absolutely. Right. Perfect example. All right. The cabinet looks like it's coming together. The last guy that we're not so sure about is the CIA director, John Brennan. Now, this is the guy who has possibly been the toughest hawk in the entire Obama administration first term. He was the national security advisor during that period of time. He's largely associated with the drone program, with some of the interrogation programs that go back into the CIA in the Bush years. You would think this would be the tough guy the Republicans would relate to. Why does he have a confirmation problem?
I think the point the Republicans are trying to make is not so much they oppose the drone policy, is the fact that there's a hypocrisy there in the fact that they went after the Bush administration on torture, on interrogation methods, and yet the Democrats are getting a free pass on the drone program.
All right, so we're moving towards restocking the cabinet for the second term. Meanwhile, we're still trying to fill in some of the empty seats in the House that, due to retirements or resignations in middle of term, are suddenly open. Of course, Jesse Jackson Jr. has resigned in Chicago, and we've been following for some weeks the struggle to succeed him. This week, it looks like we found his successor, although it was just the primary stage. We assume the Democratic candidate will win in the general election.
Well, there is absolutely no Republican strength in this district at all. The general election, for the record, is April 9th, but for all intents and purposes, Robin Kelly, the former state representative, African-American woman, will be the next member of Congress succeeding Jesse Jackson Jr. She won the multi-candidate primary.
Multi-candidate.
And she won with 52% of the vote, and a lot of it was perhaps because, or at least due in part, to the $2.2 million that Michael Bloomberg's Political Action Committee brought into that congressional district in Chicago on the issue of guns.
The voters of this congressional district understood that they and their children and grandchildren are at risk with guns on the streets.
You know, you wouldn't normally expect that the results of a congressional race in Chicago would bring a comment from the mayor of New York.
Right. And Debbie Halverson, one of the unsuccessful candidates in Tuesday's primary, former congresswoman, one-term congresswoman, also a white candidate and race did play a part, but more importantly, she had a very strong rating from the NRA, and that's what brought Mike Bloomberg into the district. Halverson was trying to make the case that these carpetbaggers from New York City are trying to tell us how to vote. Well, that's what she did.
But she did, but is she not something of a carpetbagger herself, coming from the suburbs and into a district that's still predominantly a black district in Chicago?
Well, she's not a carpetbagger in the fact that where she lives is part of the 2nd Congressional District, but the point is that her views on guns and, let's face it, her race were out of tune with the majority of the district, and she paid the price, and she tried to make Michael Bloomberg as the outlier and the intruder.
But, and she probably got some pushback votes on that.
But she only got 26% of the vote, which is even a weaker turnout than when she challenged Jackson in last year's primary and got 29% of the vote. But anyway, the point is guns probably did make a difference in that election, but I think ultimately Robin Kelly was the strongest candidate of the top candidates in the race. She was clearly the most in favor of gun control, and gun violence is really doing a number on Chicago, has been for some time. It's getting very bad.
It's getting to be ground zero, really, of gun violence as a national issue. Do we expect Mike Bloomberg, with his more or less unlimited funds, to get into other special election races around the country on the gun issue?
Well, I do. I mean, basically, a lot of people are saying that he was responsible for Joe Baca, the Democratic congressman from California, who lost to another fellow Democrat in 2012. He's looking to target pro-gun members of Congress or candidates around the country. I don't know if Chicago's 2nd District is a good test of that, because this is an urban area where gun violence is just so prevalent that you figure that the NRA is not a popular force. But if Michael Bloomberg gets empowered or emboldened by what he found in Chicago, he may go after members of Congress or candidates in districts that are more sympathetic to gun rights.
And it's interesting that we're seeing a lot of the political combat of our time fought out not so much in general elections in Novembers, but rather in primary elections, wherever they may happen. This is because so many of the districts have become so lopsided for one party or the other, and it's also because there's a real ideological homogeneity that's grown up around the parties. I mean, look, for example, at Iowa. Not a state with a gerrymandering problem, but they've got a Senate race coming up next year because Tom Harkin, long time since 1984, Democratic senator from Iowa, is retiring. Republicans would love to pick up that seat as they bid again for the majority in the Senate in 2014. And they're debating between a couple of candidates, one of whom is a very conservative candidate, Steve King, one who seemed more moderate in Tom Latham. And this week we find out Tom Latham's not going to make the fight.
Right. Tom Latham is the establishment choice for the Republican Party. One of the test cases we thought of that Karl Rove group that was going to come in and try to pick the most conservative candidate who could win in November. A lot of Republicans thought that would have been Tom Latham, but Latham announced this week he's not going to run for the Senate. He's going to stay in the House, and that may give Steve King, the Tea Party darling, an opportunity to be the Republican nominee for that seat. And the question is whether he could win statewide. There's a lot of questions whether he may be too far to the right to win a swing state like Iowa. Bruce Braley, the Democratic congressman from the eastern part of the state, seems to be the consensus Democratic nominee. And once thought of as a great opportunity for a pickup for the Republicans, again, we have a year to go, looks like a Democratic retention.
This would be Exhibit A of the argument Karl Rove has been trying to make about trying to find people who are better November candidates than primary election candidates. And that argument, I think, is also going to dominate here in just a couple of weeks when the Conservative Political Action Conference comes back to Washington. It's here every year. But I can't remember a year with quite such high anticipation for the CPAC conference, as it's often called. They're going to have a large group of speakers. And the big debating point appears to be whether the Republican Party, whether the conservative movement, and if you will, whether the Tea Party, which in some people's minds really got started at this conference 4 years ago this month.
And so you'll have Mitt Romney, you'll have Sarah Palin, you have Alan West. But one person who you will not have is Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey, overwhelmingly popular in the state, a strong favorite to win a second term. And yet, according to many conservatives, that he is not conservative enough. He embraced the $60 billion that the Congress voted to help the state in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. He gave President Obama a very visible hug prior to the election, of course.
Days before the election.
But look, I mean, if your state is suffering and somebody throws a life preserver and it's the President of the United States, how do you not embrace that?
But he did, and it was widely perceived as having made Barack Obama look more presidential in the last 72 hours or so before the election. It certainly was no good news for Mitt Romney. And I'm not talking about the vote in New Jersey. That was a foregone conclusion. But in much of the country, the last impression they saw was a bipartisan agreement that Barack Obama was handling a big weather crisis really well. Natural kind of contrast there with Katrina. It helped. It was just one more log on the fire there in the last days before the big national election.
But once again, it points out this chasm, if you will, in the Republican Party. Here you have Chris Christie, again, one of the most popular Republican governors in the country, one of the most popular governors in the country, yet he's purposely shunned from CPAC because of these breaks from Republican orthodoxy.
You mentioned Mitt Romney, you mentioned Alan West, both of whom were defeated in November.
Exactly.
And there are, I believe, seven other speakers at this particular conference who, the last time they ran for federal office, for Congress, for president, were losers. And then you also have people who are not in that category, but who have, well, a kind of a question mark over their head. Sarah Palin, for example. Rick Perry. I mean, what's the trajectory on Rick Perry that you would want to have him there speaking at this conference? There are an awful lot of people who are there because they've shown fealty to a certain conservative orthodoxy, even though it meant losing the election that mattered to them. And that should theoretically matter to Republicans and conservatives.
Well, a good argument when you talk about Rick Perry is Rick Perry, unlike Chris Christie, unlike Rick Scott, unlike John Kasich, other governors of Florida, Ohio, respectively, he will not take the federal Medicaid funds, the contributions from the federal government. He says that Obamacare is still a disaster. I am not taking the money. Other Republican governors like Chris Christie will take the money, and perhaps, you know, Rick Perry standing tall among his fellow Republicans on principle, that's one of the reasons why the CPAC folks won him there.
One note before we leave today. Interesting note, historically, the timeline, if you will, the juxtaposition of the Supreme Court reconsidering a key element of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 on the very same day this week that the president was in Statuary Hall in the Capitol unveiling the statue of Rosa Parks, if you will, the patron saint of the 1950s, beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement.
You're absolutely right. The contrast between honoring Rosa Parks for what she's done, and I'd like to point out that in 1990, I had the honor of meeting her when she came to Capitol Hill, a very moving, for me at least, I don't know how she felt about me, but it was very moving getting to meet her and talk to her. That happening at the same time the court is reconsidering the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the changes it might make in voting laws.
The president went to the Capitol to add his respects at the time of honoring Ms. Parks.
She defied the odds, and she defied injustice. She lived a life of activism, but also a life of dignity and grace. And in a single moment, with the simplest of gestures, she helped change America and change the world.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Rachel Lyshinsky and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
If you miss me in the cotton field, you can't find me nowhere. Whoa, come on over to the courthouse. I'll be voting right there. I'll be voting right there. Whoa. Miss me at the back of the bus. You can't find me nowhere. Oh, come on over to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. Oh.